From unknown causes, this joker happened to be suffering from some kind of global desertification. It was like a landscape on Mars. And here was the downed ship. She was called the Pennsylvania. She had been caught in a dust storm when she tried cautiously to cross the Joker, and then one of her helium sacs, maybe already carrying a fault, split open at the sudden expansion caused by the heat of the Joker's dry air. The leak had been quick, but the crash slow, relentless. It must have been a terrifying experience. The gold dust passengers saw the wreck now through a veil of wind-blown dust that hissed against the windows, the remnants of the storm that had killed the ship. From the air, it was a 600-foot reef, already half-covered by drifting red sand. The gold dust was the first of the following fleet to come upon the wreck, and the largest. As Dan and Helen hung back, trying to keep out of the way, there was a hasty conference call with the captain in his cabin and the commanders of the other craft as they arrived in this world. A strategy was soon cooked up, and the crew swung into action, with an efficiency and dedication that warmed Helen's soul. They dropped anchor, and soon had a kind of improvised elevator working, taking crew to and from the ground on an open platform. Helen saw Dan's buddy, Bosun Higgs, go down, joining working parties assembled from all the crews of the fleet. Then, as the crew worked, the captain used the ship's intercom to ask for volunteers from among the passengers to go down to help. Volunteers from among the passengers. Helen's heart sank when she heard that phrase. Of course, she couldn't stop him. It all went well enough for 3-4 hours, as the sun slowly went down and the sandstorm finally petered out. From Helen's godlike point of view, high in the sky, she watched what looked like very organized ants working on the carcass of the fallen ship. They cut channels through the wreckage, led out walking wounded, and carried out the worst afflicted and the dead. A field medical post was set up under a tent, and soon the first of the most seriously injured were being brought up to the gold dust on the elevator. The gold dust was the best placed of the fleet to take the injured on board, with a well-equipped medical bay that could be quickly expanded into a hospital. Other parties worked at salvaging what they could of the Pennsylvania's cargo, mostly corn belt wheat. Still others performed the sad duty of digging out graves around the crash site. Then there was an alarm in the wheelhouse. One of the gold dust contingent had got himself trapped deep in the interior of the Pennsylvania's envelope when a bit more of the structure had collapsed around him as he was trying, heroically, to reach one last group of stranded passengers. He was stuck in the collapsed framework, too high off the ground to be able to step out safely. A rescue attempt was quickly improvised.
"Wow," Dan said, listening to the crackly radio messages. "Who do you think it is, Mom?"
"Not your father," Helen pleaded silently. "Not Joshua. Just this once, not Joshua." A new line was let down from the nose of the gold dust, with two individuals clinging to it, Bosun Higgs and Sally Lindsay. Helen's hopes sank faster than the platform. With great caution, they were lowered through a rip in the twain's collapsed envelope and disappeared into darkness. Helen heard muttered reports on the radio link, saw the spark of cutting torches deep in the Pennsylvania's carcass, then a period of silence. At last Sally called,
"Take her up!"
Slowly, cautiously, the winch turned. The platform came up first, with Sally and the crewman trailing a length of cable. Then the line shuddered, and Sally waved a halt. Helen heard,
"He's okay. Not very dignified, but okay. Keep lifting."
Up came the cable, rising out of the wreck, and at last, lifted into the low sunlight, dangling upside down with the cable wrapped around one ankle, was Joshua. Dan rolled his eyes.
"Oh, Dad!"
Helen thought that summed it up. Eventually, to Helen's chagrin, the whole incident made it onto the outer net and the news channels. Sometimes it was hard being Lois Lane. And, as Joshua had to point out later, for Helen hadn't been looking at her, as soon as Joshua was clear of the wreck, Sally had grinned up at the watching crew of the gold dust and disappeared. Chapter 21.
As it happened, the Benjamin Franklin passed through the mine belt only a few days after the wreck. Via an Outernet communique, the Franklin had been ordered to backtrack from Reboot to a mine belt world around 70,000 steps from home, where some idiot had shot a couple of trolls. As the Franklin ploughed through the worlds, Maggie Kaufman wondered, not for the first time since the start of this mission, whether the whole long Earth was a test which humanity was singularly failing. On the one hand, there were still datum Earthers who led lives that had nothing to do with the landscape outside their heads, the immensity beyond their garden walls. And on the other hand, even now, 25 years after Step Day, there were still people stepping east and west, even to the high megas and beyond, without so much as looking up which mushrooms were safe to pick. One of the unstated duties of this voyage, as it had emerged, was to give a ride to a place of safety to the wounded, or even just the severely embarrassed, who had given up after their first winter without electricity, or a visit by an unexpected bear or pack of wolves, or maybe the odd dinosaur descendant, if you went far enough. Smart people, while they might at first have everything to learn, soon developed effective ways of making things work out here. But Maggie was seeing very little of them. Dumb people kept doing dumb things, such as shoot trolls, despite the intense political atmosphere after the Gap incident. And it was to the fallout from such dumbness that the Franklin, Maggie was finding, was repeatedly summoned. So the dirigible drifted across arid versions of Texas, listening out on shortwave, looking for a party whose location stepwise and geographically was only roughly known. The crew was intrigued by accounts of the disaster that had befallen the Pennsylvania. Maggie ascertained that no assistance was needed from her in the aftermath. At last, not far from the footprint of Houston, the ship flew over a rough campsite with a small solitary figure looking up from below. Nathan Boss pointed out a clump of woods nearby, which showed a lot of disturbance, the result of some kind of fight, maybe. And Mac gently drew her attention to an infrared image of slumped, cooling forms deep inside the forest clump, where the bodies had been dumped, evidently. Maggie, Nathan, and Joe McKenzie descended. The lone figure at the campsite, a woman, waiting for them by a smoking fire, was a tough-looking 40-something, a few years older than Maggie, evidently a pioneer type. She gave her name simply as Sally. Among the weaponry lashed to her back was a ceramic composite rifle, and she had a face full of unfinished business. Maggie knew her officers well enough to be sure they would step lightly, and she also knew, she thought, from her pre-mission briefings on the long Earth, who this woman was. Sally offered them coffee, rolls of bedding to sit on. After that, she didn't waste any time. "I don't want you here. I believe in handling this kind of stuff myself. I didn't call you." Nathan asked, "Then who did?" "He's long gone. Let out of here. However, you're here. So here's the setup. I've secured nearby several so-called scientists who have killed at least 3 trolls. Nathan asked, "Scientists?" "Biologists. Actually up here to study the trolls, so they say. One of them was the one who called for help. I let him go. The rest."
"And secured?" Maggie asked sharply. "What do you mean by that?"
Sally grinned evilly.
"The trolls were captured here for some kind of experiment in cross-breeding with other humanoids. Unsurprisingly, they resisted and stepped away, heading due west, which led to a chase and a male and 2 females being shot dead. At least that number. I didn't see it all. Left behind 1 orphaned cub. I'm sure you're aware of the furor around our treatment of the trolls just now."
"That doesn't sanction some kind of vigilante action by you, whoever you are," Mac said thickly.
Sally just smiled. "Oh, nobody's dead. They're not exactly comfortable, but nobody's dead. Unlike those trolls. And by the way, if your crew try to apprehend me, I'll step out of here faster than you can say beam me up."
Maggie was all too aware that for all Sally's self-confidence, the slightest evidence of a threat from her would bring down the lightning from the Franklin. On the other hand, Maggie needed to get a hold of this situation. And, as she thought she recognized this woman, she saw a way.
Okay, she said now. I've no intention of trying to apprehend you, Sally. We're not out here to be a police force. For all I know, these characters deserved whatever you dished out. However, I would advise you, at the least, to put aside those weapons on your back. Let's just calm tensions here. And then I suggest that you and I stroll over to that clump of woods where the bodies are and have a little parley. Get this situation resolved.
Sally hesitated. Then she nodded, dumped her weapons, and the two walked towards the woods, leaving Mac and Nathan to sample a little more much-brewed coffee.
"'Course I know who you are,'
Maggie said quickly, seeking to put Sally off her stride.
"'You do?'
"'Sure. You're the woman who stepped out of the Mark Twain with Joshua Valiente. News gets around.
More specifically, she had cropped up in Maggie's briefings as a well-known rogue element, and yes, suspected vigilante, out in the long earth.
Sally Lindsay, right? That's at least one of the names you know him by.
Sally shrugged. And I know about you, Captain Margaret Diane Kaufman.
Oh, it wasn't hard to find out about your military career.
Anybody concerned about long earth politics knows all about the Franklin and its officers, and the rest of the fleet and their galumphing Starfleet-type mission. Actually, I'm kind of glad it was you who showed up. You're evidently one of the less stupid of the Captain Kirks running around out here.
Thanks.
Sally eyed Maggie shrewdly. Listen, since you're here, and since you're evidently not some military-issue psycho,
praise indeed.
I do believe in serendipity, grabbing opportunities. There's an idea I've been playing with about law enforcement.
That's not our role, strictly speaking.
Somehow Maggie was back on the defensive.
What are you talking about?
You may be less stupid than your peers, but what a dumb mission you're engaged in. It really is like bloody Star Trek, a handful of ships patrolling an infinity of worlds. Look, if you want to manage the Long Earth, then you have to get holistic.
I've no idea what you're suggesting.
I'm suggesting you need an ally that's spread as wide as the Long Earth itself. She looked directly at Maggie.
I'm talking about trolls.
That took Maggie totally by surprise.
What?
Use the trolls. Take a couple on your ship, even. Look, they are, or were, being used all over the Long Earth already, wherever people want a friendly hand. Why not the military, too? They have an extensive communications system, coupled to a huge folk memory.
The Long Call.
Yeah, not to mention being somewhat physically intimidating. This was too much for Maggie to take in. It occurred to her that her mission had evolved a hell of a way from that tough love speech by the president to this. On the other hand, maybe she should be making some kind of response to this business of the trolls.
I'll need to think about it. Why would you want this?
Sally shrugged. I'm on the trolls' side.
How better to protect them than to have them work with the soldiers?
Also, maybe it will help them learn to trust us again. They reached the clump of forest. Maggie followed Sally into the shade, where they found two dead trolls. The third, Sally mentioned, had presumably left a corpse off on some stepwise world, and a live juvenile, still trying to cuddle up to one of the bodies.
You say you have these scientist characters stashed somewhere nearby?
You'll find them. You better had, in fact, before the other trolls get here.
What other trolls?
Sally gave her a knowing look.
At twilight, young though it is, this orphaned cub will attempt to join in with the Long Call.
That will summon other trolls, and when they turn up... Look, trolls are comparatively merciful, more than most human parents would be, but they are protective of their cubs.
Point taken.
They began to walk back to the fire. Listen, Sally said now, apparently on impulse. There's something else. Since I believe you have the right stuff, Captain Maggie, take a look at this. She rummaged under a small heap of gear and pulled out a piece of shining tech. It was a tube encrusted with keypads,
vaguely resembling some kind of musical instrument, but technologically advanced. It was like an ocarina, redesigned by Einstein, Maggie thought. This is a troll call.
A what?
Call it a two-way translation device for talking with trolls. I'm pretty good at it by now. I can call for help, or to signal danger. I mean, our language is nothing like theirs. This is just a prototype. And you can't get across much more than basic concepts. But for now, it's the best we can do. With a few trolls on your ship, and one of these...
How do I get hold of one?
Oh, it's not for sale, said Sally. But I could get one for you from the manufacturer.
Who is the manufacturer?
Asked Maggie. Sally just smiled. Maggie took a leap into the dark.
Okay. Get me one. That way I keep my options open, and I will consider what you've said.
Good.
How will I find you?
Oh, you'll find me, right? You're getting the hang of this. Any dirigible crew, when on the ground, were routinely wired up and monitored. Maggie's officers had, of course, overheard every word. Nathan Boss thought they should have apprehended Sally Lindsay, or at least tried to. And Joe McKenzie thought she was crazy even to be thinking about taking trolls on board.
I don't know, Mac. We do need new ways of working out here. I've learned that much in the past month. I mean, she's right. Once you are more than 10 steps from the datum, it's like interstellar space. You can't control the long Earth like it was some occupied city in a war zone. Or even Datum, New York. Freedom's a mess, isn't it? Listen, Mac, do some research for me. Find me some troll experts.
Chapter 22. The gold dust and its accompanying fleet crept through the low Earths, the last couple of dozen stepwise worlds before the datum. The skies were pretty crowded over these relatively heavily developed worlds, and as the ships were stepped through, collisions were a real threat. In the last few worlds, they actually had to follow a scout on the ground, who would step forward, check out the route, and then come back when the way was clear. But even the clutter of West 3 or 2 or 1 was as nothing compared with what they found when they finally crossed over to the datum. They looked down on the landscapes of West 1, and then, with that last step, it was as if somebody had exploded a daisy-cutter bomb, scything away the greenery for miles around, and replacing it with concrete, tarmac, and steel, staining the shining river a turbid grey, and penning it in with reinforced banks and bridges, all under a grubby, colourless sky. Joshua thought you couldn't have had a better demonstration of what humanity could do to a world, given a few centuries and a lot of oil to burn. The gold dust herself seemed diminished as she settled gingerly towards her docking apron, and the very first detail Joshua saw as he disembarked, on the wall of an old brick warehouse, was a giant portrait of President Cowley, standing there glaring, with his arm held out and palm upraised, as if to say, "Keep out." Sally, following Joshua, glared around dismissively. She was back with them, however briefly, from her latest jaunt. Long as he'd known her, Joshua still knew little of the various channels through which she kept in touch with what was going on out in the long Earth, a vast domain which, in some sense, she seemed to feel responsible for policing. Now she said grimly, "Welcome home." The disembarked passengers were decanted into an immigration hall, a huge processing area full of snaking lines and checkpoints and screening booths. Homeland's goons, visored so you couldn't see their faces, threatening instruction posters on the walls, enigmatic banners, Genesis 3:19. Like what he recalled of airports Joshua saw now, this train station had brightly signed links to other transport networks, planes, trains, buses, cabs. Transport had been one of the few big growth industries on the datum since Step Day. To make a long-distance journey across a low Earth, it was still generally easier to jump back to Datum Earth, catch a bus or plane, and step back once you'd reached your destination. But to access those services, you had to get through immigration. Joshua checked over his little party as they waited in line. Dan, who had never had an experience like this in his life before, was confused. Helen looked stoically patient as ever. Bill was still paralyzed by his latest hangover after his send-off by the crew of the Gold Dust. Sally just rolled her eyes at the endless stupidity of humanity. And as they waited in their line, a man approached them, small, intense, dressed in a black cassock, dog collar, and crested hat. Dan flinched back as he drew nearer. The guy carried a Bible and a small brass globe on a chain, from which the rich scent of incense wafted. He was evidently working the waiting crowd. Coming right up to them, he pressed a leaflet into Sally's hand. "In the name of the Lord, now you have returned home. Stay here, on the Datum Earth, the one true Earth." Sally glared at him.
"Why should we? Who are you?"
He said earnestly,
"There is not a shred of evidence, either scientific or theological, that the discarnate soul can travel crossways through the worlds. Let your children die there, out in the wilderness, and their souls will never find their way to the bosom of the Lord."
He crossed himself.
"And as you know, the day of judgment is approaching. Even now, on all those so-called stepwise worlds, at the heart of all those godless copies of the true America, fire and brimstone are spreading sulphurous fumes across Yellowstone."
Sally just laughed and told him in crisp Anglo-Saxon to go away, more forcibly than Joshua would have dared. The man shuffled off in search of easier targets.
"Well, he was a bit mad," Bill said.
At last they reached the front of the line. Here their bags were opened and searched meticulously, and each of the party was put through a whole body scanner. Joshua and Sally were first through. On the other side they were both issued with wristbands, brightly coloured, and no doubt studded with tracker technology, that they would have to wear at all times until they left the datum. As they waited for the others, Joshua murmured,
"I don't get this. All this processing and screening. All new since the last time I came back. But what's the point? I know there are stepwise hazards for the datum. Infectious diseases, invasive species. But all these barriers. The long earth is an open frontier. Here we are, obediently riding in on a twain and arriving at a transport hub. But we could step back anywhere on the datum, with a backpack full of longhorn beetles. There's no logic."
Sally rolled her eyes. "It's all symbolism, Joshua. You never do get stuff like this, do you? This is President Cowley saying to his voters, 'Look how I'm protecting you. Look how terrible these travelers are. What a threat they are.'"
She glanced at the banks of security processing gear.
"Also, there's a lot of federal money to be earned by the companies that manufacture gear like this. Fear generates big profits."
"You're very cynical."
"Joshua, cynicism is the only reasonable response to the antics of humanity, especially on the datum."
At last, Dan, Helen, and Bill came through. Dan was wide-eyed and bewildered, but not actively scared, Joshua was relieved to see. Reunited, they picked up their luggage and moved through a crowded outer hall, looking for a cab rank. Joshua noticed a feature that was new since he'd last come through a place like this. Small patches of the crowded sidewalks, marked off by yellow hatching, reserved as stepping areas that you otherwise tried to keep clear so as to allow an unimpeded flow through. Only on the datum would you need such controls. He felt an uncomfortable claustrophobia just thinking about it. And now another man approached them, this one in a smart-looking business suit, carrying a plastic shopping bag. Evidently, they weren't to be left alone for a minute. Age maybe 30, this guy had thinning hair, spectacles, and a winning smile. He stood directly in their path, so they had to stop. Joshua thought he was probably another religious nut. Then the man said clearly and calmly,
"Welcome to Earth, mutants."
And he reached into his bag. Joshua lunged forward, putting his body between the man and his family. From the corner of his eye, he saw Sally pick up Dan and step away in an instant with a pop of imploding air. And the man pulled out a blade, short, heavy, wicked. In one movement, he hurled it. The knife hit Joshua above the right breast. He was thrown back, pain flooding him. He saw Helen charge forward and ram her fist into the man's face. She was a midwife and strong in the upper body. He was laid flat out. Cops and other security people came running. For Joshua, The world grayed and fell away. Chapter 23
Your would-be killer is called Philip Mott, Monica Jensen said, as she poured Joshua's coffee, a junior attorney working for one of the big railroad combines. No previous record, no significant contact with the police. He's not a phobic, as far as we know. And he's not a home alone, that is, never dumped by a family stepping away, a common trigger for this kind of behavior.
Joshua knew all about that syndrome. Helen herself was the sister of the Madison bomb accomplice Rod Green, a home alone gone rogue.
But, Jansen said, Mutt doesn't own a stepper box. He's hardly ever stepped at all as far as any of his character witnesses testify. He has been running with President Cowley's Humanity Firsters for years, some of the more rabid elements, which even Cowley now officially disowns.
Joshua shifted in the sofa, which was a little too deep for him to feel comfortable. A couple of days after the attack, his shoulder was healing, but he was still strapped up and was prone to deliver stabs of fresh pain if he didn't favor it. Sally sat beside him, cradling a coffee mug, perched on the edge of her seat. As ever, she looked as if she was about to bolt through the door, or out of this reality altogether. Dan, meanwhile, was outside, playing basketball with Bill, using a rusty old hoop fixed to the wall of Jansen's house. Joshua could hear them running around in the sunshine, Dan jabbering out some imaginary commentary. And Helen, incredibly, was in custody on assault charges. They were staying with Joshua's old sparring partner, former MPD Lieutenant Monica Jansen. Jansen's house, here on the outskirts of Madison West 5, to which the residents of Dayton Madison had been rezoned after the nuke, was typical low-earth architecture, a massive structure of wood, of a quality that would once have been impossibly expensive on the Dayton. Jansen's personal past showed in the way the place was studded with bits of high-tech gear, a widescreen TV, cell phones, a laptop. Jansen was in her 50s now, but looked older to Joshua's inexpert gaze. She was thinner than he remembered her too, her hair grayed and cut short, and he'd noticed a line of medicines in small white plastic bottles on the mantelpiece over the big fireplace. And just above the mantelpiece was Joshua's sapphire ring on its leather loop, hanging in pride of place from a picture hook on the wall. Encouraged by Helen, he'd brought the ring here with the vague intention of showing it, one of his few impressive trophies of his travels, to a few discreet friends. On the TV, some geologist was crawling around a bubbling mud pool in a copy of Yellowstone, on some low earth or other. Apparently, there had been similar disturbances at Datum Yellowstone, and at some of its low earth footprints. The jokey commentator was talking about geysers failing, wildlife fleeing and such, and how it was actually good for business of the national park, with people coming in to rubberneck the latest thonic turmoil in the stepwise copies. Maybe that religious nut of the Twainport had been right about the fire and brimstone at Yellowstone, even if he made the wrong interpretation. Sally said now, "So this Mott guy has never pulled a stunt like this before?" "Not on the record, no, but a lot of the firsters are like that nowadays. Their strategies have evolved. They soak up the propaganda, they stay quiet, under the radar. They take to carrying around stakes." Joshua asked, "Stakes?"
"That's their jargon for the weapon he carried. Like staking a vampire, you know, a stake of iron for a stepper. Very hard to police. And then, out of the blue, they find themselves in some situation where they're presented with a target of opportunity, such as near a Twain terminal, but outside the security barriers. So nobody knows what he has in the bag, where this guy met you, Joshua."
"And recognize your face," Sally said dryly.
"And bang. He would have been aiming for your heart, by the way. Even if you missed the heart, he might have caused you problems if you tried to step away with a chunk of steel sitting in your chest."
Sally grunted.
"I'm hearing that there are countries on the datum where governments are doing that kind of thing purposefully, surgically fixing iron clips to your heart or an artery."
Jansen said,
"Yeah, they call it stapling. Look, don't worry, Mott's still in custody. He'll be charged. Datum law enforcement isn't what it was in my day, but you don't get away with attacks like that."
"And nor does my wife, it seems,"
Joshua said bitterly. I can't believe they charged Helen with assault.
Well, she did lay the guy out. Quite a haymaker. She'll get off with a reprimand. It was self-defense.
She's still in custody. They took away her stepper. Won't even give her bail. How long will we have to wait to get her out?
That's the policy now with non-residents of the Low Earths or the Datum, I'm afraid.
Sally shook her head. The Datum's become a world full of paranoids, run by paranoids. No wonder we never come back.
Well, you came back this time for a reason, Jansen said to Joshua. You're meeting with Senator Starling, right?
To talk about this issue of the trolls, yeah.
He shrugged, making his shoulder ache anew.
Thanks to you, Jansen. I know you opened a few doors to set that up. And now I'm doubting the wisdom of coming here at all.
You have to try, Sally snapped. We went through this back in hell knows where, he said tiredly.
Sure, but now we're here, it's obvious that the issue of the welfare of trolls isn't going to be at the top of the Datum political agenda.
Jansen nodded.
You may be right, but the case of Mary out in the Gap has made the news even on the Datum. It's such an exceptional case, such obvious cruelty and injustice in the middle of a space program, for God's sake. It couldn't be higher profile, and presents an opportunity for change, which is why I did what I could to help set up your meeting with Starling.
Sally said,
Exactly. Joshua, what's the use of your having a famous face if you don't use it for good?
He grunted.
All my famous face has done for me so far is get me stabbed, my wife put in custody, and my kid scared out of his wits.
Jansen glanced out the window at Dan.
Oh, I think that little pioneer's tougher than that.
Joshua grimaced.
President Cowley would say he's a little mutant.
Jansen smiled sadly.
Also a sinner.
Sally nodded. Genesis 3:19. We saw the posters. Joshua closed his eyes, remembering Bible classes at the home. What God told Adam and Eve after the expulsion from Eden. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground. For out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return.
That's it, Jansen said.
God has put us on this world or worlds to work.
You coma types, happy to just wander around, or at least that's how you're painted here, are a bunch of slackers. Without work, mankind can't progress, and so on.
Joshua sighed. And so, pushed by such madness, we slide into war or something.
Jansen sipped her coffee. Joshua thought he saw her shiver, though the day wasn't cold.
He asked gently,
And how are you, Monica?
She looked up. Best to stick to Lieutenant Jansen, don't you think?
You're settled here in West 5.
Well, nobody's allowed to stay long back in Datum, Madison, even now. They might let you back for a while, Joshua, if you want to see it.
I could pull a few strings. It's an eerie place to see.
The wildlife is flourishing. Prairie flowers sprouting in flash-burned rubble. America's Chernobyl, they call it.
It's slowly healing, I guess,
he said carefully.
And are you?
She looked at him tiredly.
Is it that obvious?
Sorry.
Don't be. It's leukemia. My own stupid fault. I was too eager to go hopping back and forth to the Datum after the blast. But it's manageable with drugs, and they're talking about gene therapy.
You always tried to put things right, Joshua said abruptly. That's what I always recognized in you.
She shrugged.
That's a cop's job.
But you took it a bit further than most. I always responded to that.
He reached over, wincing as his shoulder ached, and touched her hand.
Just don't give up yet, okay?
Sally stood up impatiently.
If you two are going to get all mushy on me, I'm out of here.
Joshua turned.
You're not going already.
She winked.
I always have chores, Joshua. You know me. I'll be back.
So long, Lieutenant Jansen. And she disappeared with a soft pop. Jansen raised her eyebrows.
I'll make some more coffee.
Chapter 24. Marlon Jackson, Senator Starling's aide, was determined to take the meeting with this bizarre, valiente, pioneer-type character on the chin. Jim Starling was mostly manageable in Jackson's experience. Regrettably, the senator had a good, if erratic, memory, which could make him devilishly difficult to steer in the way a decent aide should be able to. But at least the senator's tantrums were generally short and futile, and in that the man was not unlike Jackson's great-grandfather's description of Lyndon B. Johnson. A goddamn tornado until he ran down, and then you could get the work done. Jackson's forebears had been behind-the-scenes toilers for democracy for generations. But great-grandpa had never had to deal with modern technology, such as a diary system into which an appointment for this Joshua Valiente had got inserted, even though everybody with access denied putting it there. Even when Jackson managed to delete the entry, it got put back again. Evidently, Valiente had some kind of support. Jackson, an old hand in D.C., knew the signs. And it would have to be someone like Valiente, who last time Jackson had seen him in person, had been stonewalling a Senate board of inquiry about his spectacular but mysterious jaunt across the long earth in an apparently pilotless ship. Driven by apparently covert technology, some of which was subsequently gifted by the Black Corporation to the nation, much to the silent fury of the nation's political classes. Valiente, a walking, talking symbol of the long earth, backed by some kind of hidden hand, Valiente, who had forced his way in here, more or less, to face a senator whose main support base despised the new colonies and everything about them. A clash of minds occurring just as the political situation vis-à-vis the colonies had never been trickier, what with the Valhalla Declaration on top of all this crap about trolls. In Jackson's world, this was a small incident, but one out of control and fraught with danger, like a hand grenade rolling across the floor. If he just got the chance to smooth out the senator's more idiotic brain dumps into something that sounded like constructive dialogue, then everything would be fine. You just had to hope in this business. He gulped down one of his ulcer pills. In fact, Joshua Valiente and his buddy, both dressed in Bonanza-type dung-colored pioneer gear, were a few minutes late when security finally showed them into the office. To Jackson, they looked like an eruption from America's semi-mythic past into the clutter of this mid-21st century office. After a curt introduction, Valiente went straight on the attack.
7 minutes late because of your security protocol. Are you afraid just of me or all your voters?
Before Jackson had a chance to respond, Valiente looked around at the hunting trophies on the office walls.
And what decor! Looks like they're all either inedible or from a protected species or both. Nice symbolism.
His companion guffawed. Jackson hadn't yet said a single word.
He was struggling here. He felt as if he'd been hit by some primal force. Why don't you take a seat, Mr. Valiente and Mr.?
He glanced at his briefing. Chambers? At least they complied to that degree. What was this Valiente? Jackson's briefing had suggested some kind of retard with nothing more than a gift for stepping. He was evidently more than that. His very voice was strange, Jackson thought, as he tried to size up this man. A voice which laid down words as a poker player laid down cards, with finality and decision. He seemed slow rather than fast, but relentless. As hard to stop, once he came rolling at you, as an oncoming tank. As for the trophies on the wall, Jackson knew that the tiger head had been acquired by Starling's grandfather, who'd bought it from a dealer in Chinese aphrodisiacs. But most of the rest were the result of the senator's own efforts. All these trophies were a signal, Valiente was right to spot the symbolism, to inform any visitors that the senator had an impressive and well-oiled armory and was not shy of using it. But then, practically everybody who voted for him was a firearms enthusiast. Jim Starling was not a man to take any notice of latter-day eco-tards wetting their pants because they thought somebody was killing Bambi out in some dismal stepwise earth. Which, of course, was the background to this whole business. Anyhow, this was not Jackson's problem. He just had to get through the next hour or whatever until these guys were shown the door.
Coffee, gentlemen?
Chambers said.
You wouldn't have a cup of tea at all.
Jackson made a call. The drinks arrived in a couple of minutes. Then, to Jackson's relief, he heard a flush from the bathroom. The door opened, and the senator came in with, fortunately, for once, everything safely stowed away. Starling, a burly 50-something in shirt sleeves, evidently in the middle of his working day, looked disarmingly welcoming. The colonists stood up and looked a little less, well, bristling, as the senator shook their hands. This was what Starling was good at, working people even from the first second he walked in a room. And Jackson could see it shook Valiente up when Starling asked for his autograph as they sat down.
"Not for me, it's for my niece. She's a big fan."
Valiente seemed to feel the need to apologize as he signed a card.
"I didn't vote for you. Postal votes don't get out as far as hell knows where."
Starling shrugged.
"But you're still my constituent, according to the Aegis definition and the electoral records."
Joshua maintained a legal address at the home in Madison West 5.
"And you're in politics yourself now, right?"
He flipped through the paperwork on his desk.
"A mayor in some pioneer-type community. How admirable."
The senator flopped back in his big chair and said,
"Well now, gentlemen, you came all the way back from your distant Earth. You came all the way into D.C. You wanted to see me urgently. So let's get to it. I believe the issue is game preservation in the subsidiary Earths, yeah?"
"Yes, sir," said the Irishman, Bill Chambers.
"No," said Valiente, back on the attack again. "Trolls aren't game. Now, there are no such things as subsidiary Earths. Every Earth is an Earth, a whole world. That's a very datum-centric point of view, sir."
Jackson drew breath to intervene at this point, but the senator took this with good humor.
"I stand corrected. But the Earths that interest me are the ones containing U.S. citizens under the Aegis, and my concern is to ensure that our citizens are allowed those liberties that our Constitution demands."
He shuffled his paperwork, glancing over it again.
"I believe I understand why you're here, but why don't you put it in your own words?"
Valiente was no orator, evidently, Jackson saw, despite his own political experience. Haltingly, as best he could, he tried to summarize the concerns gathering across the long Earth over the treatment of the trolls.
"Look, when I heard about this notorious case of Mary and her cub at the Gap, I was dismayed. But it's only the tip of the iceberg where the trolls are concerned. At hell knows where, you know, we protect our trolls under a citizenship extension." "What? You're serious? So, how far do you take that?" "Oh, don't answer that. Look, whatever hayseed laws you pass in who knows what, hell knows where, don't amount to a hill of beans back here, as your type might say. Let's get to the point. These trolls are humanoids, right? Humanoid, pre-human, if you like, but not human. No matter what ordinance you pass in your hick Blazing Saddles type town, they are animals, and, according to my best advice, dangerous animals. So we have these creatures out there, powerful and aggressive creatures who, according to you, should not be killed or otherwise inconvenienced, yeah? I have read the paperwork, even though my assistant probably thinks I haven't." And he winked at Jackson. "Powerful, aggressive animals, and now, killers."
Valiente said,
"Powerful, yes. Even a female troll will weigh as much as a sumo wrestler, and can punch like a heavyweight boxer. Aggressive, only if they're pushed. Mostly they're helpful."
"Helpful?" "Senator, humans and trolls work together. It happens all across the long Earth, even in the low Earths. Hell, you must be aware of that. The economic value add of troll labor." The trolls had become an ever-present in the worlds colonized by mankind. To pioneers bereft of heavy machinery, trolls were willing and clever workers who would clear your field, tote your bales of hay, even help you put up the schoolhouse. Nowadays, in the more developed societies in the low Earths and beyond, trolls were put to work on the vast sheep farms that covered many parallel Australias, even shearing and spinning the wool, and in the tremendous rubber plantations of stepwise Malaysians. They even worked in the assembly lines of factories in some low-earth Americas.
That's as may be. Starling riffled the paperwork. But here I have a sheaf of reports of attacks by these trolls of yours on humans, in one case leading to a man being paralyzed, in another a small child traumatized and its mother left lying dead, and so on. What do you say to that?
Senator, trolls are only dangerous in the way that bears in a national park are dangerous. I mean, every so often some dumb tourist wants to get a picture of his toddler sitting nicely with a cute little cub. That kind of ignorance is bad enough back in the original USA, but it's deadly on the stepwise Earths, which are all more or less wild. We tell people this all the time. In most stepwise worlds, being dumb is a prelude to being dead. And the situation's going to get worse, Senator. The trolls have something called the long call, which means that eventually every troll in every world gets to know what every other troll knows. It takes a while to permeate, but sooner or later, if humanity treats trolls as ferocious animals, then our relationship with them everywhere will be fundamentally altered. Starling laughed out loud.
And that, sir, sounds like a lot of woo-woo tree-hugger bullhiggy to me. The long call? You'll be warning me about the wrath of Iowa next. Bottom line, Mr. Valiente, our citizens must be protected, even from being dumb, which is not a crime. Good heavens, if it was, the jails would never empty, especially here in D.C. Ha!
Valiente pressed his point. All I'm asking for, sir, is some kind of declaration that the United States gives the trolls the status of a protected species throughout the aegis.
That's all, is it?
Starling spread his hands.
But you must know that the situation regarding animal protection is complicated in this country as it is. We have federal laws, but a lot of legislation is at state level. Who exactly is it you want to define these laws, let alone enforce them? And in any event, as with so much concerning the so-called colony worlds, there's endless debate about how our datum laws extend out there.
He glanced again at his briefing.
I see you've floated the idea that these trolls of yours could be considered an exotic species. If so, they would fall under the Department of Agriculture, Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. But there's a counterargument that they aren't exotic at all, but endemic. I mean, they're native to all the other Earths, aren't they? So the old categories don't necessarily apply, legally or morally, it seems to me. As regards the specific case of this base of the gap, if it was under the U.S. aegis, they would need a Department of Agriculture permit to justify the troll's use in research. They should have gone through a process of obtaining such a permit, and maybe there's some control to be applied through that route. But you see, Mr. Valiente, though U.S. citizens are involved in this work, as I understand it, this gap base isn't even in the U.S. footprint. Somewhere in England, right? Maybe you should be arguing your case in London, not here.
He shrugged and pushed away his paperwork.
Look, the legal position is vague, and the issue lacks moral clarity to me. I am listening, gentlemen, but I don't consider the case made. At best, all I could do is bring your concerns to the Senate, but I don't believe I'm minded to do that. And besides, you're missing the wider issues.
What wider issues?
Whether you like it or not, Mr. Valiente, there are questions of national security involved here. This isn't about animals, for cripes sakes. I'm talking about threat. That's what concerns my constituents here on the datum, the threat of the unknown. It wasn't so bad when all we had to think about was aliens coming at us from another planet like in the movies. Shit, at least we'd get warning, you'd think. At least we'd have a chance of shooting them out of the sky. But now we have open borders, it seems to me. Now the aliens could just walk in.
The Irishman, Jackson had to check the name again, Bill Chambers, spoke for the first time, all but.
Senator, you're talking about these mad military twains you've sent out all over the place, aren't you?
Starling leaned forward. Jackson tensed, ready for trouble. He knew the warning signs when his lord and master was getting pissed.
Yes, sir, said Starling. That's one response. Somebody must plan for the worst eventuality. That's the job of a responsible government.
To Jackson's horror, Chambers actually blew a raspberry.
Ah, come off it, Senator. Are you kidding? This is just another boondoggle. A spending free-for-all, like the missile gap after Sputnik, like 9/11, like Madison. The vaguer the threat, the more money you get to chuck at it, right? Look, I live out there, and here's what I say. I say you can't have one government for a million Americas, and this proves it. It just can't work. It would be one god-awful bureaucracy. Well, so it is already. Hell, after all those centuries, the feckin' English never even managed to run Ireland properly. How are you lot going to manage this?
Valiente laughed.
You better not go repeating that when those Navy airships show up over our town hall, Bill. Yeah, maybe you should hold that thought, pioneer guy.
But Chambers wasn't quite done.
You know, before Step Day, one world was enough for you characters. Because you didn't even know the rest existed, did you? Now we've gone out there and made something of it all. And you lot who stayed at home, what a piece of the feckin' pie. Suddenly one world is no longer enough for you. Can't you just leave us alone?
Starling just looked at the man steadily. Then he sat back and turned to Valiente, to Jackson's relief. At least it didn't look as though there'd be any actual physical violence, not this time.
You know, Mr. Valiente, Starling said now, I have nothing to say to your companion here. I'm kind of disappointed in you, however. I understand you are known to be a truthful man, a careful man. I have seen depositions commending you for valor when you were younger on Step Day. Quite a number of young people owed their lives to you. Then came that episode when you went charging off into the long earth, going where no one had gone before, right? All very admirable. Now you come in here with these ridiculous demands, this bullshit about these animals. I'd have thought you'd see a bigger picture. Ah, what the hay.
Then he grinned unexpectedly. This was often Starling's way, Jackson knew, to become good old boy expansive, having mauled his opponent to his satisfaction.
Listen, let's not part on bad terms. I believe you to be brave, but naive, just as you probably believe that I am a mere tool of the military-industrial complex. Nevertheless, you have spoken your piece and done it well, and I enjoyed disputing with you. I suspect your sister Agnes would be proud of you, if I may say so.
That caught Valiente short, as no doubt it was meant to. Jackson was impressed Starling had read that far in his briefing.
Oh, I know all about the home that used to be on Allied Drive, Mr. Valiente. It's become part of your legend, for better or worse. And I met Agnes once, when she came into this office to harangue me about a different issue. I was very sorry to hear about her death. I know she meant a great deal to you, and other former inmates.
Valiente actually smiled, which was a measure of Starling's charisma.
Well, thank you. She had a calm death. There was even a representative of the Vatican at her funeral. A nod of respect to a worthy foe, I imagine, from what I understand of her career. Yeah, even though they used to say she was the worst Catholic since Torquemada, or so she claimed. You know, Mr. Starling, I don't exactly miss her. Somehow, it's as if she never died.
Chapter 25. Helen was waiting for him when he got back to Jansen's house in Madison West 5. To their shared relief, she was out of custody now, but under house arrest here at Jansen's. She listened to his frustrated account of his meeting with Starling. Then, to distract him, she showed Joshua correspondence they'd been sent on the Black Corporation's latest iteration of its Colony in a Box package. This was a technology they'd been prototyping at hell knows where, in fact, evidently hoping to exploit Joshua himself as a poster boy face for the program. It had now developed into a neat, integrated concept, a one-stop drop at a new colony site by one of the larger twains containing technological manna from heaven, such as satellite navigation, supported by no fewer than 3 microsats, injected into synchronous orbit by a compact launcher, enough equipment to seed a first-class hospital, a kit for a basic online university, complete with a choice of virtual professors and comms gear, from old-fashioned landline telephony to shortwave radio packages and CompSat aerials. More exotic items included a few bicycles for fast transport before the horses arrived, advice on mail-order marriage partners. The most sophisticated bit of kit was a matter printer, able to convert basic raw materials into complex parts. But such gadgets, Joshua knew, were prone to break down. And with the general stalling of technological development after Step Day, there hadn't been much advance in areas like nanotech. What was likely to be more useful to the average colonist, he thought, was the miniaturized set of basic how-to manuals, encyclopedias, even a pharmacopoeia. A basic thrust of the package was that you were encouraged to link up, initially through the shortwave, with other colonies sharing the same stepwise world. No one colony alone might be able to support a decent college, for example, but share your resources around the scattered townships of a whole world, and you might just manage it. That was my idea in the first place, Joshua said. The lateral link-ups. I like the idea of folk thinking of themselves from the outset as citizens of a whole planet, of a world growing sideways rather than just stepwise, a new world, without borders from the beginning.
You're just a latter-day hippie.
Identities change. The old concept of nationality just melts away. Maybe we'll see an end to war through initiatives like this. A new start for all of us.
And now, you sound like Dad. Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, Helen said, only mildly sarcastically. Shakespeare, I believe.
I think you'll find it was Wordsworth. Sister Agnes used to come out with that line a lot.
His wife watched his face.
You still miss her, don't you?
Agnes. You've mentioned her a couple of times since we've been back here.
Joshua shrugged. Well, here we are, back in Madison, and Senator Starling mentioning her through me. As he intended, I suppose. Agnes was the best thing that could have happened to me when I was a kid. Same for all of us. They want me to go back sometime, you know, to the home.
Will you go?
Maybe. Not to be the great Joshua Valiente, alumnus made good. Now an icon of the long earth and a mayor, and blah blah. As long as they just let me talk to the kids about stuff like, I don't know, knife usage, field medicine for beginners, how to make the night sky your ally with the Big Dipper a place to hang your hat and Orion your friend to guide you home. That's what I would have wanted to hear back then. I do wish you could have seen this blissful dawn. Agnes, I mean. I ought to get some flowers for her grave.
Was she the type who would want flowers?
Joshua smiled.
She always said no to flowers. Then she'd accept them and grumble about a wicked waste of money, and would keep them in her study until the petals dropped off.
Helen kissed him on the cheek.
Go now.
What?
Just go see her. Never mind some invitation from the home. Go for yourself. You'll feel better for it. Don't worry about us. We're not going anywhere. I'm not, anyhow.
He slept on that. Then, the next day, he went. In Madison West 5, this new city that was growing up to replace the bombed-out hulk of the old, based on a new post-Step Day urban development where, as it happened, Helen had briefly lived with her family before their stepwise trek, the home had been duplicated meticulously, aside from having various floors fixed. Joshua himself had given over some money to see to that. Sister Agnes had lived to oversee the rebuilding. And then she had died, in the autumn sunlight of a new earth. She had been buried in the sight of plenty of important people, some of whom, Joshua knew, would frankly have liked to see her dead a lot earlier. For now, her body had a brand new cemetery plot, all to itself. It was a clear, bright May afternoon when Joshua arrived with his bouquet and placed it dutifully on the stone in this small plot outside the home. There were flowers here already, from the sisters themselves, and from other grown-up inmates who had benefited from Agnes's indefatigable patience, her thoughtful love.